Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we continue our series on Rome, from Republic to Empire. Previously, we spoke to Edward Watts about the ancient Roman Republic between the years 280 BC to around 130 BC or so. We talked about how the Republic worked, its similarities and differences to modern-day republics, including that of the United States, and how what seemed to be at the time a forever war against Carthage would change Rome and transform the Republic. It is important to point out that at the U.S. Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and the debates surrounding the formation of a new government, that they were all very much based on the framers' understanding of the ancient Roman Republic. And the framers' goal was how to create a republic that doesn't get thrown into chaos, that, as Aristotle predicted in his work Politics, would lead to the ascendance of an all-powerful emperor. Well, today's show is about the 100-plus years in which the Roman Republic descended into chaos caused by factional fighting that at first seemed very political but would turn violent and inevitably result in the death of the Republic. We are once again joined by Edward J. Watts, who holds the Alcibiades Vassiliades Endowed Chair at UC Davis, where he teaches ancient history. He is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. Edward Watts, yesterday you explained how the three Punic Wars with Carthage transformed Rome into being this major power of the ancient Mediterranean world, which brought it great wealth, and yet with that wealth, great inequality among the people within the Republic. And as you said, was not so different to what happened in the United States over the last 60-plus years after World War II, and that this inequality would put stress on the Republic that inevitably down the road would break it. But let's begin at the start of that process with two brothers around 130 BC. They're known as the Gracchi brothers, Tiberius and Gaius. Tell me about them.
So these are the figures that if you were to ask a Roman historian in antiquity, where does the Republic change? They would point to Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. And the reason for that is, I think, in large part because you see the way that political discussions proceed changes fundamentally with the Gracchi. And the person really, I think, to put our finger on is Tiberius Gracchus. Tiberius Gracchus is a person with, say, a pedigree that you could imagine in modern terms to be maybe a combination of the Bushes and the Kennedys. You know, this is somebody who comes from the best families of the Republic in the second century. He's descended from the person who vanquished Hannibal. He's descended from, on the other side, a very, very well-respected tribune of the plebs and a former consul. He is as blue blood and as establishment a political figure as you find. But Tiberius Gracchus, you know, he spends the early part of his career really burnishing those credentials as somebody who is on the fast track to being a dominant figure in Roman political life. But there is a moment in the middle part of his ascent up the political ladder where he gets caught up in a campaign in Spain where the Roman army is defeated and captured, and Tiberius Gracchus has to negotiate a surrender agreement. Now, Tiberius Gracchus was not in charge of that army, but he had credibility with the Spanish tribes who had defeated the Romans, and he was able to negotiate this surrender agreement. But when the Roman armies returned from Spain, the opponents of Tiberius Gracchus's commander negated the entire agreement and wanted to send the entire army back to Spain. And Tiberius Gracchus ultimately manages to frustrate this, but this was something where the political establishment felt like the army should have been sent back to Spain, and Tiberius Gracchus was seen to stand in the way of that. And his ability to now project establishment credentials was destroyed because he had appealed to the population in order to block this. And so Tiberius Gracchus is at a bit of a loss at what to do next. And this happens while the political crises surrounding economic inequality are really starting to bubble up in a serious way. The inequality had emerged probably starting in the 160s and 150s, and people in Rome were generally patient to try to allow the Republic to find some sort of a solution to this. But after a generation, the patience is starting to run out, and people become more and more inclined to accept that maybe something more radical needs to be done. And so Tiberius Gracchus campaigns for a position as one of the tribunes of the plebs for the year 133. And once he gets elected, he proposes a measure to redistribute publicly owned land that had been rented by people in excess of what was legally tolerable. And the proposal was that this land above that threshold would be redistributed to poor people who didn't have any land and would therefore provide some opportunities to people who felt like they were missing out on the economic prosperity that was going on around them. The measure was a pretty middle of the road proposal. You know, it was taking public land. It was compensating the people whose rent for that rent of that land would be taken away from them, and it was redistributing that public land to poor people. And it wasn't even a radical proposal because something like that had been proposed a few years before. But once it's proposed, the Senate makes clear that it does not support this. And one of Tiberius Gracchus's fellow tribunes said, if the Senate is not going to support this, I am going to veto this law. And traditionally, that would be the end of it. If a tribune is going to veto a law proposed by another tribune, most of the time, that was the end of it. The tribune would stop pursuing the legislation and the discussion would move on. But what Tiberius Gracchus decided to do instead was to appeal directly to the people and to say to the people that if you want this law enacted, you have to remove this tribune from office. And that had never been done before. It was not illegal. And that's what's important to understand. It was not illegal to do what he had done or what he was proposing to do, but it just wasn't done. And so when he proposed to do this, no one was quite sure how to react. And I think a lot of people felt maybe he was bluffing. But in the end, the opposing tribune upholds his veto, and Tiberius Gracchus then holds a public vote, and he's stripped of his office, and he's removed from office, and then the law is put through. And the next step in this is the Senate then has to provide funds to authorize this and to make this actually happen and to support the surveyors and others who will go out and survey the land and redistribute it. And they say, we're not going to fund this. And then by chance, a Roman allied king dies and leaves his kingdom to the Roman people. Now, traditionally, the Senate would then decide what to do with the kingdom. But Tiberius Gracchus says, you know, the tribune actually can summon the people and the people can vote on what they want to do with this property. And I think they should pay for the land commission. And so he summons the people and they vote and he takes this property and uses it to fund his land commission. Now, this, again, wasn't illegal, but it had never been done before. And each time he summoned the people to vote, Tiberius Gracchus would do this in a way where he was surrounding himself by, you know, large and intimidating supporters, and maybe a crowd of them, you know, maybe tens, maybe hundreds. But there was always this vague feeling of menace about him when he was doing these kinds of activities. And it was not lost on his opponents that he was using threats to try to push through things and push through ideas and measures and policies that hadn't been done before. In ways that hadn't been done before. And so when Tiberius Gracchus's term was up, he decided that the best course of action for him politically was to run again for the tribunate. And his opponents became very alarmed by this. And they became especially alarmed by the fact that he had these supporters and he might actually be at some moment inclined to use them. And so they set upon him, attacked him, and killed him. in order to prevent him from ever using violence or intimidation to overthrow or upset the functioning of the republic. And this was the first time that political violence had been used in Rome since the 5th century BC, the first time in more than 300 years that there had been political violence in Rome. And so this, to Romans, represented the failure, a signal failure in the republic to do what the republic was supposed to do, you know, to govern political life in a way that facilitated compromise and consensus building, and establish clear rules for how decisions would be made and a clear limit on what kinds of punishments would be inflicted on people who either lost a political conflict or who were on the wrong side of a political victory.
And they would even enact and leave in place these land reforms that Tiberius Gracchus had pushed for, because they probably were popular amongst the people, and it could have been problematic if they did not. But I guess what happens, they're not fully funded. They eventually become just ignored, and then this whole issue is not done because we have Tiberius's younger brother, Gaius, who comes upon the scene.
Yeah. So I think, you know, what the Senate and the opponents of Tiberius Gracchus realized is the policies were, first of all, broadly supported, and second of all, not that radical. It wasn't like the confiscation of private property. It was public property that was being given away. And so this was something that was, you know, they weren't happy about it, but they could tolerate it. But they also weren't particularly interested in keeping it going. And so the Land Reform Commission that he set up seems to continue operation, but not very actively. And then when we get to the 120s, we have the beginning of the career of Tiberius's brother, Gaius Gracchus. And I think of all of the figures in the last century of the Republic, Gaius Gracchus is the one that you might be able to step back and say, this is somebody who was, first of all, a genuine man of principle, and second of all, maybe even a hero. Because what Gaius Gracchus realized is there were genuine problems in how Rome was functioning, how it was treating its poor, and how it was treating other people in Italy. And he also completely understood that as a Gracchus, he was now seen as a radical figure. There were just people who would always oppose him simply because of his last name. And we're told that before he entered political life, he even had a dream where Tiberius Gracchus appeared to him and said, you will enter political life and you will be killed for doing so. And so Gaius Gracchus went into this with his eyes open, fully understanding that he was never likely to be consul. He was never likely to have a high office in Rome. And he was actually probably unlikely to be able to leave political life without being attacked or maybe even killed. But there were things that needed to be done, and he felt that he alone had the capacity to do them. And Gaius Gracchus also was one of the most powerful orators of his day. You know, he was, in a sense, maybe the Obama of that moment. And so when Gaius Gracchus stepped into political life, he had a genuine conviction to pursue economic and social reform, and he was completely aware of the fact that this very well could result in his death. And so his program actually was, in some ways, much less calculated than Tiberius's. What he was interested in doing was remaking the entire spectrum of opportunities available to Romans, especially Romans who were not of means. And so that meant colonizing the site of Carthage, that when Rome had defeated Carthage in the third century or the Third Punic War, Rome had destroyed the entire site of the city. But it's a great city site. There's a reason that that place was significant, powerful, and wealthy. And what Gaius Gracchus proposed to do was to send Roman citizens and Italians who didn't have land and settle them in Carthage so that they now had the opportunity to build a new life in a place that was fertile and potentially economically, you know, had tremendous economic potential to increase their wealth. He proposed a grain dole that would provide subsidized food to the poor people in the city of Rome who couldn't take advantage of this kind of enterprise. He proposed revitalizing the land commission and having it start its work again. And he did all of these things fully aware of the fact that in the end, probably what would happen is that he would lose his life. And in the end, that is what happened. He he ends up being confronted again by senatorial opponents, and he ends up being killed. And this time, large numbers of his supporters, maybe thousands of his supporters, are killed alongside him. And that, in a sense, is bracketed with the career of his brother, and it's in large ways influenced by the career of his brother. But the destruction and the effect on the Roman psyche of the murder of Gaius Gracchus was much more significant, to the point where the person who sponsored the attack on Gaius Gracchus actually had to build a temple to Concord to try to rebuild a sense of harmony in the Roman state, because his actions, it was thought, had so disrupted things that it would be difficult perhaps for Rome to come back from.
And this is starting to make political violence normal within the Republic. This is not at the end of the Republic. We still have, like, what, another 70, 80 years to go. This is quite a long process. But I'm getting the sense here, the violence that we were seeing that had occurred during the times of Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, no longer is it just politics that are happening. Now it's political violence in order to get your way. This is what leads the way. This is what paves the road into the next generation and the conflict in the next generation that would be represented by two figures, Marius and Sulla.
Yeah, I think what's important to see is that you have a gradual escalation in the use of threats and intimidation and then violence. So Tiberius Gracchus uses threats, but not violence. Violence is used against him, but it's relatively few people who are killed. And then with Gaius Gracchus, it's a large number of people who are killed. But what you see there is threats and violence are becoming part of the political vocabulary. And I think that's what's important to understand, is this is in some ways a break with how the Republic works. But in other ways, these are now becoming political tactics that you can use to behave politically within the framework of Roman politics. And so violence now is a political tactic. And that is the real danger, because once it enters into the realm of the possible, people can begin to think about how to use it better. And this is where Marius and Sulla sort of come in. Because what they realize is there are ways to use this, not just as a sort of one-off to pick off your enemy, but you can use violence in a way that is systematic and profoundly destructive, but also something that can be used to completely shape and reshape the way that politics are happening. And the real development that makes it possible for them to, in a sense, almost industrialize violence is a decision that Marius makes when he is elected consul. Marius is elected consul to pursue a war in North Africa. And it is a war that had been going on for a while. Rome had not been doing very well in it. Some of the commanders had been corrupt. Some of the people prosecuting the war had been paid off by the enemy. And Marius was brought in on the promise that he could quickly win this war and do it with forces that would be powerful and loyal to him. And the problem that Marius had was Rome at that point only accepted people into the army who had a certain amount of property. And most of those people had already been brought in to fight in that campaign in North Africa or in other ongoing campaigns. There wasn't a ready body of recruits for this new army that Marius was going to lead into war. And so what Marius decided to do was to enroll people who didn't meet that property qualification in the army. Now, again, this is not illegal. It just wasn't done.
Also means poor people.
For good reason.
It means poor people, regular people now can get in.
Poor people, and especially those poor people who now for almost 50 years have been seeing their economic prospects constricting. And now war and military service becomes a way to further your economic prospects in this moment where the rich continue to do better. And the people who are among the elites continue to get wealthier and wealthier. Marius's army now can bring in people who just feel like this is a way to better their lives. But the key part of that is the army has to be successful. And when the war is over, it's possible if your commander is influential enough that the Senate might even vote to give you land and property as a reward for your service. But what that means is your commander has to be successful and he has to be influential enough to make that case. And when Marius's army goes into North Africa, it is successful. He's wildly successful. So much so that he's brought back, and many of those soldiers are brought back, and they're brought back to fight a war in northern Italy against Germanic invaders who have come across from what's now southern France. And that army is also dramatically successful. And when Marius comes back, he pushes forward a set of proposals using his allies in the magistracies to reward his soldiers. And the Senate is actually somewhat alarmed by this. I mean, they see why Marius is doing this, and they understand that Marius is building a dedicated block of supporters that concerns them. And so the proposals to reward his soldiers are not going anywhere until Marius calls those soldiers in to demonstrate in the city of Rome. Now, this is not violence. They aren't marching on the city of Rome, but they are very capable, very powerful, armed men demonstrating in the city on behalf of their commanders. And that is intimidating. It's threatening. And the measure gets through. Now, the next phase in this comes about almost a little more than 10 years later, when Sulla is in line to get a very, very lucrative command to go and fight in the Eastern Mediterranean. And his soldiers are looking at the possibility of following him and looting some of the richest cities in the world as part of that campaign. And allies loyal to Marius work in the Roman assemblies to have that command pulled away from Sulla. Sulla then goes to his army and asks them to march on the city of Rome. Now, when Marius's forces had done this, it had been in the course of a demonstration. It had been Roman citizens exercising their right to voice an opinion. When Sulla does this, it's not to demonstrate, it's to conquer. And so Sulla's army marches on Rome, it takes the city, and using the violence that they have inflicted, it gets Sulla put into this position of command.
Yeah, and this is the first time a Roman general had attacked Rome.
This is the first time in history a Roman general had done this.
This is a period of time in which all these guys have their own armies, their own militias.
Yeah, these armies are loyal to their commanders because the opportunity you get from serving in the army is tied to your commander's ability to secure rewards for you. And if Sulla is marginalized, his soldiers are not going to get those rewards. And so when Sulla asks them to march on Rome, he doesn't even need to tell them that it's in their personal interest to do so because they understand it viscerally. And they march on Rome for Sulla, but they march on Rome because Sulla can give them something. And they are more loyal to Sulla than they are to Rome, because Sulla is the one who can secure benefits for them, not the Republic and not their fellow Romans. But again, what we see is this is an evolving, this is an evolution of a political technology, a use of violence for political ends. From Marius is calling his soldiers in to demonstrate, to Sulla using his soldiers to attack the city of Rome, it's not a major jump. And it's also not a major jump from the use of violence to political ends, but it is a better calibrated and more effective and more devastating use of that violence. And that is something that the Republic really struggles to recover from.
And Sulla would also change how the Republic functions too. And a couple of really important things that he would do was that he would change the office of the dictator. And this is where dictator comes from, and it's such a negative term today. But in the Roman Republic, you had the office of dictator that was meant for an emergency because you may not have time to deliberate, go through the entire political process to respond to an emergency. So an office of dictator would be created. Dictator would then you'd have your dictator who would have about 6 months to be able to deal with whatever particular emergency that would arise. And then that then it would come to an end after 6 months. He occupied that office of dictator and prolonged it for as long as he would stay in Rome to institute his changes. So there's one change of prolonging indefinitely how long one can use the office of dictator. And then conversely, he also restricted what the office of the tribune, you know, the protectorate of the people could do.
Exactly. And I think you sum up precisely why the dictatorship existed in Rome. You know, the Republic is designed to move slowly, but sometimes you can't move slowly. And you need someone who can make a decision and act on that decision quickly. And that's what the dictatorship was designed to be, was the office that in an emergency could respond quickly to a situation. And what Sulla did was he took this office that's supposed to respond quickly in an emergency and effectively said, the emergency is perpetual. And I need to respond to this perpetual political emergency until I feel like it's fixed. And so he held this office for a much longer period of time than anyone had held it before. But he used the office to push forward a set of reforms for how the Republic would work. And Sulla's idea, in his mind, was that what he was doing was perfectly consistent with how a dictatorship was supposed to work. You know, if there is an emergency, the dictator is supposed to come in and find a solution to that emergency and put that solution in place so the emergency is resolved. And then once it's resolved, he resigns from his office and the Republic goes back to how it was. For Sulla, the emergency seemed to be tribunes of the plebs who are overly ambitious and are doing things that disrupt the acting and the functioning of the Republic. And so what he did was he eliminated the ability of any tribune to aspire or even hold higher office. And therefore, you couldn't go and become a tribune and use it as a launching pad to a consulship or another magistracy. You just, if you were a tribune, that was the end of the line for you. And so anyone who is ambitious now wouldn't be a tribune. And anyone who is a tribune wouldn't have any incentive to do anything aggressively because it would lead nowhere. And there was no reason to take the personal risk that would come along with it. And so from Sulla's perspective, that actually was a solution to the problem. But from the perspective of Romans, this is actually a real problem because the tribune had traditionally been the voice of the people. It had been the place where, even if the reforms weren't enacted, you could at least have a discussion about how to move forward and further the interests of individuals who maybe are not politically as important as, say, a consul. And when Sulla undercut the tribunate, he undercut the ability for regular people to feel like their voices were able to be raised against societal and political inequalities. And so that action of Sulla's did not actually stay in place for very long because simply Romans were not willing to accept it. And it only lasted for about 10 years. But when that was undercut, the entire reconstruction of the Republic that Sulla had put in place was also undercut because the entire reconstruction now had no credibility. And so by the time Sulla puts all of this in place around the year 80 BC, and by 70 BC, nearly all of it is dismantled.
And this would lead to civil war?
The dismantling of Sulla's structure actually didn't immediately lead to civil war. And some of that is because the civil war that Sulla started by marching on Rome was so horrible that the generation that lived through it was actually very averse to that kind of behavior. Huh. And the men of that generation, it's remarkable when you think about how their careers ended. But in the 60s and the 70s, men like Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great actually felt very strongly that political norms needed to be upheld, and violence was something that needed to be forever taken out of Roman political life, because they had seen what happened in the civil wars under Sulla, and they didn't want that to come back. And so the dismantling of Sulla's reconstruction of the Republic wasn't something that immediately led to civil war, because all of the people who were coming into office at that time remembered what civil war was like, and they had suffered through it. Caesar, for example, had all of his father's property confiscated, and Sulla had asked Caesar to divorce his wife. Caesar had suffered horribly in the civil war, and he knew what civil war looked like. And so even though the Republican structure that Sulla put in place had fallen apart, there was still a strong commitment in the 60s, especially, to the idea of a republic. Not so much because it was working, but more because civil war was so horrible that they wanted to avoid it at all costs.
So that does now lead us to Julius Caesar. And this, Julius Caesar, one of the most famous names of all history, especially within Western civilization, his name still used today. He is the nephew of Marius. His aunt, Julia, married Marius. And I guess from my reading in your book, Marius wasn't a name you really talked about in public in the years after his death, but Caesar would resurrect Marius's name and his legacy and kind of hang on to his legacy at his aunt's funeral, where he gave the oration.
This is one of the geniuses of Caesar. I think what we see with Caesar is a person who combines the ability to intuitively almost understand the popular mood and how to shape it with an absolute gift as a military commander and an inspirational figure. And what we see across Caesar's career is somebody who understands what gifts he possesses and how best to advance his individual interests by bringing forward one of those particular tools that he possesses. And the rehabilitation of Marius is a great example of this. When Sulla launches that attack on the city of Rome, Marius is the person who's charged with defending it, and of course doesn't manage to successfully defend the city of Rome. But Marius and Marius's son and Marius's ideological allies continue the fight against Sulla and ultimately lose the civil war. But Marius becomes the symbol of the losing side. And so what Sulla does is he pulls down all of the images and commemorations of Marius around the city. And even though Marius had been a very successful military commander and had held the most consulships of any Roman in history, his memory is basically eliminated from the public space of the city of Rome. And what Caesar realizes is that there is a tremendous support for Marius, especially after everybody saw what Sulla had done. And if Sulla frames Marius as the antithesis of Sulla, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it was very hard legally to do anything to commemorate Marius. At the funeral of Marius's widow, however, Caesar is in charge of organizing that funeral. And what Caesar realizes is there's a perfect opportunity there to goad the supporters of Sulla into overreacting. And so he displays images of Marius and Marius's son at the funeral. And the supporters of Sulla, as Caesar understood, completely overreact and say that this is sedition and Caesar aiming at dictatorship. And the case Caesar can make is quite easy, right? Who can have a funeral for a woman and not display anything relating to her family life? You know, how can you commemorate this woman who is blameless without talking about her children and her husband? And Sulla's supporters, who condemned the display of images of Marius, look like complete reactionaries. They have completely marginalized the position that you can't claim Marius's legacy because they've looked cruel and inhumane in doing this. And this is a indication of the way that Caesar will advance his career. He's always very careful at managing his public profile and doing things in ways that put his opponents sort of ill at ease or unbalance their ability to respond to him. And he combine that with an incredible power as a speaker and a communicator. And so as Caesar's career develops across the 60s BC, what you see is a figure who is understanding at particular moments what move most benefits him. And so early on, it's displaying Marius's images so that Caesar can get a reputation as the intellectual and ideological heir of Marius and immediately build an identity for himself and a base of support for himself. Then in the middle part of the 60s, there's an election to become the chief priest in Rome. And this hadn't really ever been a competitive affair in quite this way. But Caesar mobilizes for it like it's a political campaign. And he ends up winning election, shocking the world that he would be able to do this. Then in 63, there is a attempted coup by a man named Catiline, and Caesar alone speaks up and says, we should not execute people without trials. We should not ever break with the laws and conventions of our republic just because we're excited or alarmed at a particular moment. And this is wonderful because it now opens up Caesar. It opens up for Caesar this idea of being a principled defender of Republican practice. And it provides insulation when later Caesar might go against this. But it's really in the campaign for the consulship in 59 that you see Caesar completely aware of how to mobilize popular opinion. The story of that campaign is remarkable because people did recognize Caesar's talents. And one of the people who particularly recognized this was a man named Cato. And what Cato saw in Caesar was someone who was profoundly dangerous to the functioning of the Republic. And Cato resolved to block Caesar from winning that election and do anything he could to block Caesar from winning that election. And so Caesar was scheduled and hoped to kick off his election campaign by staging a triumphal procession into the city. But the rule about staging a triumph is you're not allowed into the city of Rome until you celebrate your triumph. But to stand for election, you had to go into the city of Rome and declare your candidacy publicly. And what Cato did was he changed the date of the triumph so that the triumph actually would have to occur after the date, the last date when you could declare your candidacy, forcing Caesar to either choose to declare his candidacy or hold the triumph. And what Caesar decided to do was to make it known to everybody that he had secured the triumph, but that he was going to turn it down to go and declare his candidacy, and therefore blocking Cato's obstruction. And once Caesar comes in as consul, what you see is a figure who is, again, completely aware of the power he has to shape public opinion and completely aware also of the moments when it is most effective to bring that public opinion out in support of a proposal. And so in 59, when Caesar is consul, his co-consul resolves to block a number of the measures that Caesar has proposed to put in place. And Caesar manages to sidestep him completely and sidestep the Senate completely by taking these proposals to a popular vote. And this wasn't what consuls had usually done. But in doing this, Caesar is able to use his ability to command the loyalty of a crowd to generate tremendous support for proposals in ways that had never quite been tried before and were very much not in keeping with the way the state had worked in the past. And so this is ultimately what sets Caesar up for the command that will make his career. Cato, in a sort of parting blow to try to prevent Caesar from fully optimizing the potential of being consul, had arranged for the command given to the people who had been consuls in 59 to not be anywhere where you can win major victories, but instead to effectively serve as park rangers in Italy. The command was to be control of the woods and trails of central Italy. And what Caesar managed to do was to build popular support to change that allocation from the woods and trails in Italy to Gaul. And this is where Caesar sets out to conquer what's now modern France and parts of Belgium, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. It's through mobilizing popular support and recognizing the potential that he would have to really take advantage of that. And so this is what we see in Caesar, a figure who is incredibly talented, but also incredibly calculating in how he deploys those talents to benefit himself.
So after Sulla makes changes to the Republic, it's still a Republic. You can still identify it as a Republic. Certainly made changes that would lead to more changes down the line. And so in that vein, what did Caesar do? Would it be accurate to say it was Caesar who ended the Republic? Not that they might have recognized it at the time.
I think that you could say that that is accurate, but I don't think it's Caesar alone. The generation that protected the Republic and valued the Republic in the 60s, by the 50s was, I think, becoming cynical about the ability of the Republic to actually do what it was supposed to. And Caesar helps catalyze that. The actions that he took as consul in 59, he got a lot done. And the things that he got done needed to be done. You know, they involved a lot of things that had been sitting unresolved for years. But in getting things done without following proper procedures, Caesar, again, had broken with this idea of consensus politics and had instead forced ideas through simply because he wanted something to get done. And once Caesar left to go and conquer Gaul, there was a hangover that everybody in Rome, I think, sensed. You know, that now this idea that you have to work within the structures of the Republic, however imperfect they were, people were becoming less and less inclined to think that was right. And as you move through the 50s, what you see is the Republic stops functioning. In some years, the election for consul, you know, it doesn't even happen. It's supposed to be each year before January. The consuls take office in January. Some years, the election for consul drags all the way into the spring of the year the consuls are supposed to serve. And in other cases, electoral races just didn't happen. The votes never were cast because mobs loyal to one politician or another would fight every time you tried to hold a vote. And so the degeneration of the Republic that I think one could say started with Caesar breaking with precedents in 59 becomes more and more severe as the 50s progress. And the big problem with that is once Caesar's command in Gaul is due to expire, nobody has any faith in any guarantee that the Republic or its magistrates can offer. Caesar's big concern was that when he comes back from Gaul, somebody will charge him with a crime. And there were certainly crimes you could charge Caesar with. And what Caesar hoped to do was get back into Rome, somehow get elected to an office so that he wasn't liable to be prosecuted, and work his way back into Roman society with the protection and understanding that he wouldn't actually be prosecuted or his property confiscated, or maybe he even would find himself executed. And the Republic could not provide him the assurances that he needed. And so from 50 until Caesar crosses the Rubicon around New Year's of 48, you have basically a standoff where people are trying, Caesar and Pompey in particular, are trying to figure out how you resolve a political conflict when nobody trusts each other and nobody trusts a political system to protect them if somebody with whom they've made a personal agreement decides to go back on it. And so the ultimate civil war that leads to Caesar's dictatorship is something that results because of Caesar, and it results from Caesar's actions and Caesar's inclinations, but it also results because Caesar, I think, felt like he had no choice because the Republic had failed as an entity that could protect an individual. And I think Caesar understood that the Republic could potentially survive, but it couldn't survive and Caesar survive at the same time. And I think Caesar chose his own interests over the survival of the Republic. And we could probably understand him making that choice.
Edward Watts, having dived into this story yourself and knowing it as intimately as you do, and I imagine there are people listening to us right now who will hear something and even think about contemporary times. What does this story mean for you?
I think that the most important thing that I take away from this story is that a republic that has been successful for a long time is a very strong thing. And it takes a very long time to collapse. One of the things that we have been bombarded with in the last few years are stories of the 1920s and 1930s, where republics in Europe collapse and fall into tyranny. And those stories, I think, as told, are true, but I don't think they're particularly relevant in a place like the United States, where the republic is old and it's successful. And what Rome shows is the degeneration of an old and successful republic takes a long time. It doesn't happen in a few years. It doesn't even happen in a lifetime. When you look at the process by which violence entered the republic and ultimately consumed the republic, this lasted for nearly 100 years. And each time the violence entered, what you see is a period during which the republic almost resets. Everybody says that that was horrible. Everybody again embraces the idea of a republic. Everybody tries to protect the republic and bring it back. And generally speaking, it survives and it looks like it does come back for a decade, maybe two decades. But that is significant and meaningful. The average Roman probably lived to be about age 50. And so they probably saw one political crisis in their lifetime. And when it was settled and things look like they came back, it's very reasonable to believe that the republic did come back because it had been there forever. It had been there for hundreds of years. And so one crisis couldn't doom it. But each time Romans made that assessment that the republic was back, they start taking it for granted. And they become complacent. And when a new crisis erupts that is more serious than the one that had occurred a generation before, Romans don't understand that it is now time to really embrace the republic and embrace its integrity and its strength so that it can survive in the long term. And what I take away from the analogy that we can make from Rome to our current situation, the United States is probably undergoing significant stresses. The Republic right now is undergoing significant stresses, and we are in the midst probably of a political crisis. But if this crisis is resolved, it doesn't mean the Republic is fixed and healthy and good to go for centuries. It might mean that we are just like Rome in the beginning of a process by which or in which these crises will appear and then recede. And Americans have to do what Romans could not do. Romans didn't understand that their republic could collapse and became complacent about the fact that it would always be there. And Americans sometimes fall into that same trap too. But we have the lesson of Rome to draw on. And we can understand that republics that are old and are successful and have weathered crises before still need to be protected. And at moments, Romans said this, but a lot of times Romans did not actually act in ways that were consistent with the principle of protecting their republic. And for us to preserve our republic, we need to do that. We can't take its survival for granted. We need to instead embrace the fact that it is something that is worth keeping and worth cherishing and worth protecting. And then we need to do the work to actually protect it and not become complacent and assume it will always be here. Because the lesson from Rome is if we assume it will always be there, the guarantee is it will not.
And Edward J. Watts holds the Alcibiades Vasiliades Endowed Chair at UC Davis, where he teaches ancient history. He is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny.